The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Jen Coburn and it's great you could join us. Now, autumn is well and truly kicking in, and as these nights draw closer, I'm starting to get reminded of that time as a mum myself when nights were something I slightly feared. It was that time in my life when I had a newborn, and any new parent knows nights with babies can be long. However, our guest this evening supports parents with babies through those long nights, so I can't wait to hear more. So I am delighted this evening to be chatting to Hannah. Hello, Hannah. How are you?
Evening, Jen. I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, well, we're thrilled to have you here on Mix 92.6. I wonder if you could please tell us what your business is.
Sure. So I run Night Nannies, nightnannies.com. I cover Hertfordshire and Buckinghamshire, as well as some of the London areas as well. And essentially, we provide overnight maternity care for parents. So our parents come to us with their newborns, and we can provide night nannies or maternity nurses to help them through the night. And our nannies will take sole charge of your little ones throughout the night for you.
Wow. I mean, remembering back to some of the long nights I had with my baby, it sounds like a gift from God. It sounds amazing. But I mean, that is a unique field to be in. Hannah, how did to start with, did you get into this area?
So I was night nannying myself, and I did that for a number of years. And then just very fortunately, a franchise from Night Nannies came up for sale. So I purchased that, and that was to cover North and East London. And then a few years later down the line, Hertfordshire and Buckinghamshire came up for sale as well. So I purchased that and merged it all together, and here we are.
It's fantastic. So it's nightnannies.com is the UK's largest night nanny service. Is that right? And then you've taken over this area, our local area.
Yeah. So we've been going since 1999. It was founded by Anastasia Baker. Our head office is based in central London. So Anastasia runs our head office, and then we have home counties with franchise managers covering all around southeast London upwards.
Fantastic. So just tell us, I suppose, there are a few strings to your bows then, that what you guys do and how you help parents. But let's start with a night nanny, because you also, you said that that's what you have been yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, what is a night nanny? How does that work? Maybe talk us through an evening or how it works. I'd be really interested to know.
Sure. So a night nanny, they start at 9 p.m. and they work through till 7 a.m. for you, and they will take sole charge of the baby throughout the night. They support all feeding, as you know, breastfeeding, bottle feeding, combination feeding. A lot of our nannies are medically trained as well. So essentially, the goal is to establish a safe sleep routine. So we strictly follow the Lullaby Trust guidelines. So it's really about educating parents as well into a safe sleep routine. And ultimately, what the goal is, not only for the parents to get some rest, is by the time your baby hits 6 months, that's when we would then be able to introduce our sleep training service. But hopefully, if you have a night nanny, you then don't need to go on to that, because you've established a safe sleep routine. You've got all the tools, you've got all the kit, and, you know, all the tips along the way that if babies do fall out of routines, that can be for multiple reasons, whether it's teething, illness, jet lag, you know, season change. There's so many factors to it that we like to think that parents are then equipped to be able to deal with those changes and routine shifts that come in, that they can just gradually, over a few nights, pop their baby back into their routine.
What kind of age are we talking about that maybe a night nanny would start working with a family?
Newborns. Usually the day they come out of hospital, the parents want the night nanny on the doorstep waiting for them. Or a lot of parents, you know, they enjoy, it's such a special time, and they enjoy having that first month or so at home, just in their little nest. as a family. And then usually, you know, a parent will return back to work. Usually dad will return back to work. And then that's sometimes quite a key point where our night nannies step in and they go and support the family throughout the night so everyone can get some rest.
Yeah.
And it's not something that you would need to have teed up before you have your child. If you found that after a month or a couple of months or whenever that you were actually exhausted and you could just do with a couple of nights of unbroken sleep, you know, they could people reach out to you then? It's not that they have to have started at a certain time or anything. Because no. We don't often know. Well, of course we don't know as parents
exactly
what it's going to be like. And often we want to give it a go. But yeah. I know myself, I had a postnatal doula who helped for just a handful of nights in the first few months of my son's life, because I literally needed, and I'm a solo mum, but I needed an extra pair of hands so I could just sleep at some point.
Yeah.
So people could reach out to you at any point. Is that right?
Yeah. Every family is so different. You know, we get last minute requests. So some parents will have their first scan and they will then secure a night nanny knowing that they've got somebody as soon as baby's born and for the required amount of nights and length of time. Everyone is so different. Some people come to us after a couple of months just through pure exhaustion, and some people are very last minute, and that is absolutely fine. It's a really flexible service, so no one's tied into a certain amount of nights or a certain length of time. We always keep the same nanny with the family so they can build that rapport with the nanny. And sometimes we've had, well, lots of times, the same nanny will be requested to go back for second and third babies. And they usually get in there quite soon because they always want to have the nanny that they'd had with their first. So that's really special for the nannies because they go back and they can then see the first or the second, you know, and second born. They've grown up a little bit from when they left them, and they feel like they're part of the family. It's really special. It's a really special time to be involved with a family. So it's lovely. The rapport they build with that family is really special.
Well, that's it, isn't it? I mean, inviting anybody into your house or your nest, as it tends to be called at that stage in life, is very special and very personal and actually very private. And everyone's learning. And I mean, if somebody is breastfeeding, there's boobs everywhere and milk and exhaustion and tears. And how does it work with a night nanny that relationship is made to feel secure and special, you know, and safe as well? If you're inviting someone into your house, core, you really want to make sure that someone is a safe pair of hands with this precious baby. How does that work?
So all of our nannies go through quite a strong vetting process with us. A lot of our nannies have been with us for years. So on the files, when parents receive the files for the available nannies, references are on those files. So our nannies have DBS checks. All of the references from previous families are on the nannies' files. And a lot of those families are then happy to be contacted by future families so they can have a conversation about that nanny in particular. And we all have, all of the nannies have safeguarding as well and lots of additional training. But I always encourage the families to have a telephone conversation with that nanny and then meet that nanny prior to the position starting, just so they can ensure that everybody's comfortable. And that's what's really important, to get the most out of the service as well and to build that rapport. You have to be really comfortable with somebody coming into your home looking after your baby.
Yeah, it is a very, very special and in many ways privileged job, isn't it? When you were a night nanny, did it feel like a privilege looking after this newborn?
Yeah, of course. It's amazing. It is such a privilege, and it's amazing. And when you're with a family for a long period of time, it's so lovely when you come to finish that position and you can reflect on when you first started with them. And you can imagine that some families are very emotional when you first join them, and there's no routine. Everything's kind of just a bit of a guessing game. And the knowledge that they've built from you educating them and the routine that baby's in, and it's almost like You just leave this happy little family. And a lot of families keep in touch as well, which is so nice. It's so rewarding.
I think it's wonderful. And there is a, I suppose, maybe a feeling that night nannying, A, it may be so expensive or very exclusive. It's just for the rich and privileged. Is that the case? Is that the only people that you're helping, or how accessible is it for everybody?
No, it's really not. I think maybe that's a view of the past. And we help all walks of life. And everyone has their own reason for a night nanny. Everyone has their own budget, I'd say, for a night nanny as well. And I will always try to cater for the family's needs, because a lot of the time people do come to us with pure exhaustion, and the effect that that can then have on the family as a whole, mental health. For me and my nannies, it's so important to be able to help those families that come to us from that point.
That's wonderful. So you are a service that people can reach out to. And if you are in Hertfordshire and this is resonating with you and you're thinking, oh, I could just do with that help. You know, sleep and mental health, like you've just said, Hannah, is very related. And hormones at that time of your life and postnatal depression are things that are very serious and you should really look out for. And yeah, if this helps, then that is a wonderful thing. And then I remember actually asking for it as a gift from people who are, you know, very kindly having, when you've had a baby, people offer you gifts, yeah. You know, if you're lucky.
Yeah.
And actually it was a wonderful gift to be gifted a couple of nights with, mine was a postnatal doula, but I mean, much better than a baby grow for me at that stage. Yeah. And it was game changing. I was breastfeeding at the time. And so that's another thing. People sometimes think you can't have a night nanny if you're breastfeeding, but you certainly can, can't you? Because
of course.
Explain how that works, because I was surprised by that.
Yeah, of course. We support all forms of feeding. And a lot of mums breastfeed. Breastfeeding isn't for everyone. And I think that's a really important message. It isn't for, and it, not because it's not for everyone by everyone's choice. It can be choice, but sometimes medical reasons, you know, lots of reasons, it doesn't take off. And that's absolutely fine. But if a mum is breastfeeding, of course you can have a night nanny. What the nannies tend to do is that they will have a good chat with the parents before they start the position to ensure that when the baby wakes and the baby is with the nanny, that they take the baby into the mum for a feed. And sometimes they, in the early days, the nanny will stay with the mum and help her with the technique and ensure that everything's going as smoothly as it can do. As mum gets to grip with breastfeeding, the nannies then usually allow the mum and baby to have that time to have the feed. Then they take the baby back from the mum, settle the baby. And obviously, you know, there's a change in between and winding, etc. Everything that needs to be done is done. A lot of mums also express, so they keep a stash of milk for the nannies for the night feeds. So yeah, absolutely. Of course, just because you're breastfeeding doesn't mean that you can't have a night nanny. We fully support breastfeeding.
I do remember that actually. They brought my child in and then I started breastfeeding and then brought in a cup of tea and some toast. And I thought, oh my Lord, this is the heaven sent. And then, you know, to hand him over. And again, this was just for a few nights for me, but that someone else then burped him, which could take ages, changed his nappy, settled him. It just gave you that extra hours that you were just losing at the night, because you could have been up for 3 hours every time if you were feeding for a long time and stuff. So, you know, it's not just a feed. It's always a lot more around feeding time for the mum.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So you also said that you do sleep training. And as we know, these babies, if you feed and water them, they seem to grow and they grow, but their sleep doesn't always necessarily click into place. I now have a toddler and notice the bags under my eyes. And I was wondering how sleep training worked, what ages you worked with for sleep training, because that might be something our listeners are also interested in for their child.
Yeah, so our sleep training service is, it's from babies who are 6 months plus. We do require the babies to be on at least two solid meals a day. You know, ultimately we need to eliminate hunger throughout the night. There's no magic wand, one magic wand for all babies. It's a real bespoke package. So if a family is to get in touch with me and they require a sleep trainer, I will put them in touch with somebody who will have a very lengthy conversation with them, generally about the whole 24-hour routine. It's not just split into nights and days. They need to know everything that's going on within that 24 hours, just for tweaks and to really get an idea as to where the issue lays, really, as well. So they, once they get to the family, some of our sleep trainers, they will do a 24-hour stint with the family so they can see the day and night in, you know, as it goes with the family, and then they will go from there. And other sleep trainers, they work slightly differently, and they will just do the nights, but on the first night they will be there from bedtime so they can get a really clear idea as to what's going on. Like I say, there's not, it's not one box, you know, ticks all. It is a bespoke package, so they need to see what's going on. But for sleep training, we do require that obviously baby is in fit health. There's no teething going on, any illness at all. We like babies to be as fit and healthy as possible to, again, to eliminate why they're waking. And again, to be weaned and to be on solids. So then the sleep trainers know that they've had that calorie intake that's enough for them. So then they can try and break the habit, or do break the habit of them waking throughout the night.
And do you go up to toddlers, or what sort of ages can you help? Or is it just like within the first year of a child's life you're working with?
We do go up to toddlers. Yes, we do. But I would say that usually people nip this in the bud between 6 to 18 months, I'd say, just because really I think the older the child gets, the harder it can be to break that habit. But some, you know, sometimes babies aren't very well, things happen and health can get in the way, so they have to leave it that little bit longer. And if that's the case, that's absolutely fine. Of course we can always help.
Sleep is a funny thing, isn't it, with children? Yeah. You think you've cracked it, and then a couple months later you're like, what? I thought we've been through this. We worked out you sleep through the night, but you're not now, and I don't know what's changed. Yeah. And it just changes and changes. And that's very normal as well, isn't it? I mean,
of course.
We shouldn't be also afraid of understanding that these babies are going to be up in the night. Children are going to be up in the night. And that is very normal. Like you said, there's so many things at the beginning of the teeth, the illness, a cough. I mean, a cough is an absolute game changer when it comes to sleep. So all of this is part of the roller coaster of parenting. But it is wonderful to hear that, you know, you have a service that if people listen to this, felt like they needed support, they could reach out to. Because that's sometimes it, isn't it? Knowing that there is someone out there if you feel you need it. You might not need it. Lots of people won't need it.
Yeah.
But you are there. And if some parents were listening to this, or grandparents or friends of new parents were listening to this and thinking, I'm not sure. I'd not thought about it, but maybe this is something to think about. What would you maybe say to them? You know, what would you say to them?
I'm always more than happy to have a conversation with the family. I mean, I take a lot of calls from grandparents. I take a lot of calls from sisters as well.
That doesn't surprise me.
No. And I am more than happy to have a conversation with any friend or relative, and even work colleagues sometimes, just about our service, how we can help. And like I said, it's not, a lot of people think that it's, you have to know exactly how many nights you want. You have to be, you know, you're contracted into a length of time, and you're really not. You can use it on an ad hoc basis if you want. And for a lot of people, that's really refreshing to hear, because suddenly it's, you know, they're not tied into anything. There's no financial restriction as well. So I take a lot of calls from colleagues, like I said, in that position, and I'm more than happy to have a conversation with them. Like I said, explain how it works. And I'm also more than happy to put them in touch with the nannies that would be available. And they don't have to proceed, but at least they can see who's available, how we can help. And it just almost, it opens another door, doesn't it? So you know that the help's out there. Some people contact me when the baby's first born and I don't hear from them for another 4 months. And then they come back to me and say, I contacted you, I tried, I'm exhausted. And that is absolutely fine.
I think it's wonderful. And work colleagues, I hadn't thought about that. Work sometimes does, you know, maybe club together for a present for somebody.
Yeah.
Guys, if you listen to this, club together and get them a night nanny for a couple of nights. I can tell you that's a present they will always be thankful for. If somebody did want to get in touch with you, and it's so wonderful, Hannah, because you sound so approachable, and it is kind of taking away the edge of mystery around this, or, you know, yeah, that it's this privileged thing. If someone did want to get in touch with you, how do they do that, Hannah?
So they're very welcome to visit our website, which is nightnannies.com. There's lots of information on our services on there. And there's a little box where you can input your postcode and that will direct you to the branch manager for your area. All of our contact details are on there, our phone numbers and our email addresses. So you're very welcome to reach out at any time.
Oh, that's fantastic. I've so enjoyed chatting to you, Hannah. It's
Thank
brought
you.
Back lots of memories, some not so good, but actually looking back on it, it's such a special time and it is a time to be cherished, and maybe a bit of extra support and a bit of extra sleep makes it all a bit more enjoyable.
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us. And do reach out, listeners, if any of this or anything that Hannah has said has resonated with you, with someone you know or yourself. Thanks so much, Hannah. Take care.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye.
Bye. We'll take a quick break now on The Parents Show on Mix 92.6.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Welcome back to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Thanks for staying with us. Now, if you're looking for something to do with the kids during half term, you could step back in time with a visit to the Celtic Harmony Camp to see how the ancient tribe celebrated their new year. They're gearing up for their biggest family event of the year, the Samhain Celebrations. The celebrations are happening between the 27th and the 31st of October at the camp's location near Hartford. It's a family day out with activities like the Spooky Woodland Quest, Celtic drumming, a fire procession, and even a wooden burning man. Mix Morning's Ian Pritchard spoke to Sarah from Celtic Harmony Camp to find out more.
Yes, so Samhain is what we like to call the Celtic Halloween. So traditionally that's sort of celebrated on the 31st, and the idea is that back in the day, back in the Celtic times, so sort of around before the Romans or when the Romans came, they would celebrate Samhain, and that would be a big sort of, that's basically their Celtic New Year. So they'd have big fires and they'd have the big festival and all the harvest was over, and they'd sort of celebrate and they'd have all these fires lit to bring the sun back, to sort of encourage the sun back to the earth so they could start the cycle of the growing again, because they were old.
Excellent. Well, we could do with some sun coming back as soon as possible, I think.
Definitely. So in modern times that's become Halloween, but here at Celtic Harmony Camp, of course, we have to celebrate it like Samhain. So this October half term, so from the 27th, Sunday the 27th to Thursday the 31st, which is the big day, we will be having Samhain celebrations, which is family days out, where families will be invited to come to our woodland. They can go through our haunted woodland quest. They can try a lot of different little Celtic crafts, such as like making their own broomsticks and things like that. And at the end of the day, they have a big fire procession as well. So it's a very exciting time.
Fantastic. Well, for people that haven't been to the camp before, just describe a little bit about how that all works, what it is and what sort of experience people have if they go.
Yeah, so Celtic Harmony Camp is... it's definitely hidden away. Unless you were looking for it, you wouldn't necessarily know it was there. We're sort of in the middle of Bournewood in Brickenden. And it's sort of like a clearing, which has all these round houses on it, which we built. Our biggest one is our Chieftain Round House, which is always an impressive sight because the Celts used to live in round houses. So the idea is that we've built a little mini village, but we also got our woodland area, which has been cleared for hunting and different activities as well. And we've got a few different modern amenities that people like, such as toilet blocks and things like that.
Okay, that's good to have. Yeah,
but we've still got our traditional area as well, so it's best of both worlds.
And so, what do people do who come there? What do they experience?
So we do two different types of events. So we do during term time, we do events for schools. So they come to see us. They're guided round our special Celtic village on a day by one of our dressed up Celtic tribes people.
Okay.
So they'll have their own Celtic names. We've got Manachar, and we've got Caraid, and we've got Kuru, and all these different names. So we have to remember who's who, and we can't call them by their modern names. They have to be their Celtic names where they got the kids. During the school holidays, we tweak the days a little bit, and we have these family days. So basically, mainly the children that visit can bring their parents back to experience this amazing day that they've had with their school.
And so those kinds of days, is it just for kids, or do families stay with the kids? How does that work in practice?
Yeah, so obviously when it's school groups, it's the children, but during the family events, we make it like a whole family day out. So obviously there are some things that the children will enjoy more, such as the haunted woodlands. It's very exciting for the children walking through there, but other things such as drumming, parents tend to enjoy more. You get them really getting into the drumming. And also we have history talks and things like that. So we definitely try and make it a little bit of fun for everybody.
Yeah. And would people expect to spend a morning there, an afternoon, the whole day?
Yeah. So it's 10 to 4 the day. So it's a whole day out. We've got a little restaurant on site as well where we do like little burgers and things like that. So It's a nice sort of relaxed pace, and we've got activities to fill the day, but it's also just about enjoying being in the natural space, getting away from screens, that kind of thing.
Fabulous. And so the Samhain thing, that's happening over half term. That's a special event. But you run events right the way through the year, I guess.
Yeah, so we sort of tailor them to the different times of year. Again, just going with the farming calendar of the Celts. So we always do something for Easter. We do our Easter Dragon Quest during Easter. And sometimes we do things for Imbolc or Beltane, which are other different times of the year. So it's always a little different here. We like to mix it up and keep things fresh.
Fantastic. And so if people want to find out a bit more, maybe book up a slot, I'm guessing you have to buy a ticket.
You do. It's pre-bookings only. All they need to do is go onto the website, which is celticharmony.org. And on there, there's a little button that says, it says Samhain, but obviously Samhain. If they click that, there's a little page that tells them all about the day, and there's a booking button there as well.
Excellent. How much are tickets typically?
£12.50 per person, and under threes go free.
Okay, well, Sarah, that sounds super. And good luck with that, and good luck with the other events that are happening during the year at Celtic Harmony Camp.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And that was Sarah from the Celtic Harmony Camp telling us about the Samhain festival that's happening over half term and other events happening up there at their campsite near Hartford.
Thanks, Sarah and Ian. Sounds like something quite different to go and see. Finally this week, Lydia is joined by our neurodivergence expert, Karen Hannan, who talks about how neurodivergent people can be very vulnerable, as they often don't pick up the signs that others would.
Hello, and welcome to the Parents Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Lydia El Khoury, and today I'm so thrilled to be joined by Karen Hannan, who is our local resident expert when it comes to all things related to neurodiversity. So, Karen, thanks a million for joining us again.
Me, it's always a pleasure, Lydia.
It is. I love having chats with you, and I love picking your brains, because it's every time we have a chat I learn so much more, and it helps me kind of just tune in a bit more to our community of neurodiverse people. So now we're going to talk about coercion. Now actually I'm going to let you tell me what we're going to talk about, because you know better.
Yeah, fair enough. So today we thought we would talk about our neurodivergent population and the elevated risks they have to coercive relationships in a variety of settings and across the life stages. So it's an elevated risk for us. And what we're going to hopefully pick apart, because we're hoping to do maybe a little series of these talks about it, is there a risk? Why is there a risk? What's the impact of the risk? This isn't we're not going to do all this today, but this is an overview of what we're thinking of. And then what can parent carers or family members or loved ones do to reduce that risk? And also what can the person themselves do to reduce that risk? So that's our thinking, I think, today.
Brilliant, because I have to say straight up when we were chatting about what we talk about today and you were saying coercive relationships, the risk of coercive relationships for our neurodivergent population, I was thinking I had no idea this is a risk. So let's start off with, is there a risk and why is there a risk?
Yeah, there's a definite risk and there's lots of research out there that's been done around this. And the reasons for the risk, the elevated risk, is that if you sit within a minority, which us neurodivergent folk do, throughout your lifespan, you are going to have experienced social inequalities and marginalization and things like that for a variety of reasons, which we can talk about another time. But that is the reality, that our experiences in the world and the way we experience the world is more difficult than other people might experience the world and their interactions with it, because the world tends to be made and built for them, but it isn't built for us in the way we need it necessarily to always work. And so from infancy, what we begin to do is something called masking. And this is where we try to make ourselves fit in and experience better interactions with the world and less problematic interactions in the world, by working really hard to please everybody else and to fit in with their expectations. And that's not necessarily what we as individuals need. So what we begin to do, and it does start from infancy, there is research to show this, and I can give you an example of that in a moment, is we begin to put our own needs right at the bottom of the pile, and we focus very much on making sure everybody else is okay, because that way we'll be rejected less frequently. And if you think about a coercive relationship, that's the perfect person for someone, one that wants to be the dominant partner in a coercive relationship. That means we are the perfect partner for them, because we are seeking to put their needs above our own at whatever cost. And so, yeah, so that's the reality. And there are things we can do about it, which we'll cover later on at some point. But that's why we're at greater risk.
That makes a lot of sense. And I understand that we're at a greater risk, and I understand a little bit about why. Can you tell us more about the why we're at greater risk?
Yeah. So just on that aspect of masking. So one of the differences, particularly, well, around neurodiversity. So if your brain and your neurology is working differently, there are various things that it's affecting for you. And one of the things it's affecting is your sensory experience of the world. So you may have very different experiences around sight and touch and taste and smell and things like this. And so we have the example of, a 16-month-old baby, for instance. There was some research done where they were experiencing touch as painful. And so what do you think happened every time they cried, Lydia? What would someone do who didn't know that,
reach out to hold them and comfort them, I guess.
Yeah. And so what do you think the baby did in response to that in order to minimise the pain it experienced?
Yeah, cry even more, I don't know.
Stop crying.
Okay.
Because if you stop crying, no one picks you up.
Ah, sorry, I get it. Yes, and that's the habit it begins to form. I get it, sorry.
But so babies need to cry for a variety of reasons, right? You know, they're hungry, they need changing, they're feeling worried about something. So, and if you think about this baby, that is very like childish in the sense that of a very unsophisticated way of managing that situation. And if we think about how we all use learned behaviour to manage the world as we grow up, when we develop strategies as adults, they tend to be quite sophisticated because we've got a level of, you know, lots of sophisticated ways of thinking about things. If you've started to develop your strategy in infancy, it's a relatively unsophisticated way of responding to that situation and saving yourself. But when that becomes your normal response to things, what you're taking is a very childish response to a complex problem into adulthood. And so it's not a safe response for adults. It's not a safe response for the baby, you know, because imagine if the baby for some reason had broken a limb or something and they weren't crying to let people know. That's very dangerous. So that's one of the things. The other things are things like sometimes we can be incredibly literal in how we understand what people are saying to us in information. So we may misinterpret how things are, and also it's very easy for people sometimes to mislead those of us, particularly where there's also a difficulty around, you know, that notion of knowing that the information you're getting is only as valid as the person giving you the information. But, you know, there are some people I know specifically, and certainly within our community at times, where we have higher levels of trust than are actually perhaps good for us. Because we are very trustworthy, sometimes we can assume everyone else is. And so that's the other thing, is we're not necessarily able to notice when other people are manipulating us. Because if we like someone, and you know, with grooming, it's the love bombing, isn't it? If they're making us feel valued and loved, we don't see beyond that. But there are elements around having grown up with this super appeasement approach to the rest of the world that really reinforce our risk in that situation.
That's really interesting, Karen. Really interesting. And I'd love to know, and from our listeners, you know, do get in touch if this resonates with you, even if you don't have a diagnosis, or if it resonates, if it sounds like your child. You know, it'd be great to keep the conversation going outside this show or at the podcast if you're listening after it's aired, because it's so interesting, like the super appeasement and the susceptibility to coercive control is really interesting.
Yeah, and also when we talk about children, often we are thinking about up to the age of 18, but when you think about the different developmental curve of a neurodivergent brain, because, you know, I mean, it is common sense, isn't it? If our brains are different, we're going to develop differently. We're not going to develop wrongly. The way we develop is entirely normal for who we are. So number one, stop telling us it's wrong and teaching us how to be otherwise. But, you know, it means that we are evolving and developing at a different pace, a different pace and trajectory. And that can bring great strengths. And I'm happy to talk about that another time. Why is being neurodivergent brilliant? But in this series that we're thinking of doing at the moment, we're thinking about, well, what are the risks that come and how might other people manipulate and use those risks. What I was going to say is we have to think about parent carers of children. I've got adult children now. That doesn't mean they're not my children, right? Or that I don't stop thinking about those risks. So I would just say to your listeners, this really, we'd be interested to hear in terms of not only those of you that maybe have younger children, but those who have children, you know, who are teens, reaching that, you know, emerging into adulthood, 18 plus, and also a bit older, you know, what is it? What have you noticed? What has worked? And what do you think about those risks? Have you got any insights?
Brilliant. Thanks so much, Karen. And is there anything we can do to protect against it? To protect against, or like if we have neurodivergent children, or if we're neurodivergent ourselves? I mean, when I think about the qualities you're describing, they're beautiful qualities, like being trustworthy so people can trust you, or, you know, seeing the good in people when you like somebody, or... They're qualities we'd all aspire to, or even being a pleaser. I mean, in the sense, it's, you know, it shouldn't go all in one direction, but it's a nice way to be, because people who like to please, you know, are lovely to be around, aren't they?
I mean, we're going to touch on it sort of more extensively later in the series, I hope. But I think my top tip would be to actively teach our neurodivergent population to know that their needs, what they need and what they feels right for them and doesn't feel right for them, is important and valid. And we need and to help them articulate that. So if they're in a situation where they need to say no very strongly to something, we need to promote that ability to say no. And what that means for us parent carers is we need to listen to them when they say no to us. I think certainly it's hopefully becoming more and more old-fashioned, this idea of teaching neurodivergent young people to be more like non-neurodivergent young people in order to fit in. And therefore, when we do that as parents, we're actually contributing to this notion that the child came into, you know, this notion of this young child. There's something about me that's not okay. I need to be different. I need to be a different kind of person. And that's the kind of person others will accept and want. And when we try and teach those children to do, you know, we're colluding with them in that approach. That's not helpful in terms of protecting them. So we need to really promote our children and young people to be able to say no to us, to be able to say what they need. And we need to abide by it. I cannot tell you how happy I was when at 17, my youngest son, when my husband, he asked him to do something fairly innocuous, but I knew he wouldn't want to do it and it wasn't the right time. And normally it's the kind of thing I might step in to sort of manage. But he turned around and very firmly said to his dad, absolutely not, I'm not doing that, and just walked off. And I think my husband and I just sort of high-fived each other because we were so pleased that he'd been able to say no to us, because then we knew if he was in the outside world and something happened, he had the skills to do it. So we have to be prepared to move away from this idea of children shouldn't speak to us that way and really encourage it in order to address that risk.
And of course, I mean, it can be said perfectly politely. It doesn't need to be said, you know, being kind of ready to stand up for yourself is a great quality.
There's something about being assertive, Lydia, but what I would say is, in the extreme, my youngest son may be less polite than other people might like when he needs to say no. But actually, I'd rather he's safe and able to get out of the situation than worrying about the egos of other people around him and the niceties. So, you know, there are times when you are a 20-something and you might be out and about somewhere, and actually you need to really firmly get rid of people who are getting in your space and making you unsafe without worrying too much about social niceties. So I'm not saying teach your kids to be to be antisocial, but I think also we need to understand that sometimes it's about the person, that it being effective, what they're saying, rather than it feeling okay to the other person that they're saying it to.
Yeah, great. And I've got a question for you, Karen, because obviously there's diversity within the neurodivergent community. So how easy is it to generalize, you know, with the qualities that you're describing, the kind of propensity to please, that trustworthiness? Because every community is diverse. So I'd love to know what your take
is. That's a really big question. I think what I would say is that I come back to this, you know, and there's a reason we're protected under the Equalities Act, is that we experience life as a minority and a very marginalised minority, whoever sits within that disability tag within it. So where you are experiencing life at significant lack of privilege, you are likely to, and that's stigmatising, obviously, that experience. What begins to happen, particularly in children, then, is the self-stigma. Because that's what kids do. They attach to the adults and they take those notions into their own psyche. And so it's very common for some young people, or many young people, unless they've got the structure around them that's helping them to be proud of who they are and understand the positives of who they are, and that other people sometimes, it's other people who are the problem sometimes, you know, and but often when you're living life as the minority, your internal dialogue is, I'm the problem. Okay. Often when you're in that situation, you are going to become very, very people pleasy. So I think there's just an elevated risk that anyone who's at a disadvantage begins to slot into that.
That's brilliant, Karen. I've learned a lot again from a great conversation with you, and it helps me so much, and I'm sure it helps our listeners. So you're going to come back and you're going to chat to us about the risk, of course, of relationships, just why they happen. We've touched on why it happened. Then you're going to go back and talk to us about how to protect against it, how parents can protect their children against it.
I think the impact of the person, I think, is really important. And also, what do we mean by a coercive relationship? Because I think people have a very stereotypical idea, like a one-size-fits-all idea of what a coercive relationship looks like. But actually, it can be in many settings and many forms, and it can be very aggressive, or it can be very quiet, but very dark, shall we say. So, yeah, we'll cover all sorts of things when we talk about, we'll have a few sessions talking about this subject. So, and again, I'd urge people to, if they've got particular thoughts or questions or whatever, just to let us know.
Brilliant. Karen, thanks a million for joining us on the show today.
Oh, thank you. I always love it, Lydia. You know that.
Ditto. Same here. And we'll talk to you very soon.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.